Hotel history is created for adult audiences. Content may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised. You're listening to Hotel History. We take you with us through the sordid history and scandals of some of the world's most famous and infamous hotels. I'm Dieta.
And I'm Yael. Let's get started. So this episode is an interesting one. It's about ancient inns. And what's the reason we're covering this?
Well, we had a lot of fun with our medieval inns episode for Christmas. And we were thinking, okay, well, Hanukkah and Christmas happen at the same time this year. So what can we do that kind of maybe has a little bit of a Hanukkah feel to it as well as Christmas? And so we were thinking, biblical style, like what's going on with the with the ends.
Where did it all start?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And really, it definitely shows that hospitality has been a necessary part of life and travel for the entirety of human existence, just about, at least since.
So when you read the Bible, both the OG and the new G. just the Bible, I guess. But I feel like it's just all about people traveling,
yeah,
and staying somewhere for the night. They're like, and they traveled for miles, and then they stayed and ate some bread, and then they traveled again, and they had some wine.
And, exactly.
And they traveled with their donkeys and all the riches that the king gave them, and then
God said, "Don't travel here, travel there," and they did.
Yeah.
And angels said, "Good job. Now travel over here." Yeah.
Do you think God was just like one big Yelp review?
he's a travel agent.
Yeah.
he's like, I work on commission.
And then like Moses would write a review like, "Not worth the trip. Stay home."
Moses prefers a Nile front.
Yeah.
Property.
So we're gonna go back to, well, I have a question. This is a stupid question, and don't add this in if it's too stupid. But ancient Greece was before the Bible was written. I want to know my timeline.
It all kind of happens together. So all of ancient Greece is happening at the same time as some of the things are happening in the Bible. And it depends on which time period in Greece, because if you're thinking like ancient Greece or like the classical period, which was in like 400 BCE.
I don't know. I think the problem with all this ancient stuff is it gets confusing. Mm-hmm. Let me be honest. Before the year 1600, it all was ancient. Like someone, it just like, I'm like, I don't know. It sounds old. Like, sure. You know, my brain can only comprehend certain centuries.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like it's a big clump before that. Also, fun fact in fashion, because I went to fashion school, but we learned about like the history of fashion and costume, and there was like a good 300 years, literally nothing changed aesthetically, like bare minimum, because everyone was poor and dying.
This was the fashion dark ages.
It was the dark ages with the fashion dark ages. And so I think it just kind of confuses people, because you know, you can visualize certain like parts of the world at certain times. Like ancient Greece is a very specific vibe.
Yeah.
And then you go like, to, I don't know. I mean, like you can imagine in the Revolutionary War times what they were wearing and like blah, blah, blah. But then there's just like a bunch of times where it's just rags, just potato sacks, you know?
So, So when we're talking ancient Greece, think about any time from like 1500 years before the Common Era up to like, you know, 300, 400 before the Common Era. So it's a pretty big stretch of time. It's like 1,000 years.
Yeah. So the ancient Greeks, you know, they took their hospitality very seriously. That's what.
Yes. Incredibly. The Greeks took their hospitality so seriously that it is a part of their mythology, even. So have you ever heard of the Greek myth of Tantalus?
No, maybe.
I had not heard of this. I love Greek mythology, and this was the first time I had read this one. There's a few different versions, but the one that really rang true for this one is that he was punished for all eternity in Hades by Zeus. He was made to stand in a pool of water, never quite able to reach the water to drink. And then there was a tree nearby that he couldn't quite reach the fruit to eat it. So for all eternity, he can't drink or eat, but it's right out of his reach.
It's the origin of the word tantalizing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Oh my God. I figured it out. I passed the class.
So you have to be wondering, like, oh my God, what could somebody do to be punished in this horrible way forever? It was shoddy hospitality, man. He didn't.
What?
Yeah, he treated his guests poorly. So specifically, he was giving a dinner for the gods. He wanted to test them to see if they really did know everything. So he was like, maybe they can't actually tell what they're eating. So he killed his son and cooked him in a stew and served it to the gods at dinner.
Yeah.
So, of course, immediately all of the gods are like, something ain't right. Except for one, Demeter. Demeter was still upset because her daughter Persephone had disappeared and she still hadn't found her. So she's not paying attention and she takes a bite of the food. And they say that it was a chunk of his son's shoulder.
Oh, my God.
So the gods figure out what happened. They put the son Pelops. His name is Pelops. I'm going to say Pelops.
Yeah, Pelops sounds better.
Yeah, they put him back together and make him live again. But he never got his shoulder back because Demeter had eaten it. So he had to have a prosthetic shoulder made out of ivory.
This is so specific.
There's a version of Zeus that's like the hospitality Zeus, and his name was Xenios Zeus. And this version of Zeus was enraged that he had done this thing to his guests, and so he punished him.
That's, well, you know, okay. When you say shoddy hospitality, it sounds like, you know, they left some dirty towels in the bathroom. Not like he served his son because he wanted to see if they really knew everything. That is some fucked up shit, and he deserves to be in that puddle of water, whatever.
Yeah. there's shoddy hospitality, and then there's turning your guests into cannibals.
Yeah, I think he deserves the punishment.
Yeah, I would say so. I bet Pelops agrees.
Yeah. Well, he's missing a shoulder.
So according to the epic poems by Homer, offering hospitality to foreign visitors, which is the word Xenos in Greek, in one's residence was considered the greatest honor of all in ancient Greece. So hospitality is such a big deal that it's even enshrined in these, you know, Homeric poems that everybody to this day still reads and learns about. So every foreigner visiting Greece at those times was believed to be sacred. And so they were granted the protection of the hospitality versions of Zeus, Xenios Zeus, and also Athena of Xenia. So don't mess with travelers because they're protected.
Do you think that modern day Greece upholds these rules? Probably not.
I haven't been to Greece though, so I couldn't say.
Yeah, I don't know.
Couldn't say.
I mean, that's a good, like, scared tactic for people, you know, like, you better be nice to the foreigners, otherwise you're going to turn into stone.
Yeah, try to keep bandits, you know, from bothering people on the roads, or people from taking advantage of their guests in some way. Yeah. Because I think you can tell a lot about a society by how they treat the foreigner in their midst.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, people have a weird relationship with tourists. And I, as a New Yorker, I find it to be strange, because we New Yorkers were very annoying. Like, we're very, what's the word? We have things to do, places to go. We're just very anxious people. So we get annoyed at foreigner, like not foreigners, but tourists, because, you know, they want to come and see. We get annoyed, whatever. But like, I would never purposely be mean to tourists or to, there's people are like really, there's something going on where they're like, yeah, they deserve to die. Yeah. I'm like, no, I get annoyed. Like, I want them to move out of my way, but they're not like bad people for coming and wanting to see this city, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, there has to be a line. You can be like, okay, stop being like super excited about everything, but also welcome.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we said in our last one on medieval inns that the ale houses were like the old school Airbnb, but actually the ancient Greeks kind of invented Airbnb, because they actually had space in their homes for foreigners to stay there. So because it was such an honor to take care of travelers. So the landlord was called, a word that means hotelier, basically, xenodochos, which is the same word that Greeks use today to call somebody who runs a hotel.
Really?
Yeah. And they also had steganomos or estiopamon or nakliros. Okay. Titles that stated a citizen's responsibility to offer his hospitality to a foreigner. So the fact that they have that many words for it tells you how important it was. So the owner of the house had the sacred duty to offer the xenia to the visiting foreigner. That is the best possible hospitality.
That's crazy. I think that more people should take pride in their hospitality.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's so great. I mean, I don't know that I want to necessarily have to have a standing space in my house. Because
I would.
I'm going to put books there. But
so they can sleep with the books. They probably prefer it.
That's true. We had a whole episode about that.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's to have a guest bedroom. Like, it is a sign of luxury.
Yeah.
So people should be kind of proud. And I think it's a shame. I think it's a shame if you have the space and you don't offer it. You know, yeah. I think it's a very nice thing to do, to be a good host and to like have someone stay and make sure that they feel comfortable. And I'm with the Greeks on this one.
Yeah, it's a very selfless thing to do, and says, you know, I don't mind inconveniencing or myself putting myself out a little bit to help my fellow man.
So there was an exception to this etiquette in ancient Greece, and the exception was in ancient Sparta. They had a different mentality.
That does not surprise me. They were like always wanting to be the opposite of the rest of the Greeks.
Yeah, they're also like really intense. It was the so-called, I'm going to say this wrong, Xenolacia?
Yeah, that looks right. Xenolacia? Okay.
Xenolacia. So it's the intention to refuse hospitality to Xenos.
Wow.
So the opposite.
Wow.
But the Spartans only offered hospitality to famous and honorable foreigners in their state because they want the money. And they were just like against
their name droppers.
They were like the elitist hotels that we know of that are just like, oh, you're not rich and famous. Like, get out of here. We're not. But a big thing was that they were against offering hospitality because they didn't want to be influenced by other cultures.
Ah, so their xenophobia plays a bit of a...
They're xenophobic.
To the Xenos. Oh my God.
To the Xenos. It's
holy crap.
Wait a minute. So, oh, that's we're just learning English.
That must be where that that the root of that is, which I never knew, but that totally makes sense because you're, because you are afraid of whatever is different other than you, like of people who are from other cultures.
So they didn't want to be influenced by other cultures, but they seemed like such a strong, like nothing would really influence them that easily. They were so prideful.
Right. Yeah. But so I guess that shows you the fragility.
You know what they were? They were toxic men. They were so scared. If they weren't it's exactly what you think it is. I'm here. I'm loud and annoying and proud, but I'm also really insecure. And so no one's allowed to come next to me.
My armor is so thin that one little chip from someone else is going to bring the whole thing crashing down. You know what this makes me think of a little bit? It makes me think of, you know, that island that's somewhere near India where nobody can go because the people who live on the island just immediately start shooting arrows at you if you try to land your boat. That's kind of what that makes me think of.
Yeah. Yeah, because they probably know they'll be easily influenced by technology. Okay, imagine you live on this island. You're thinking like, this is the world. Someone comes and is like, here's an iPad. Forget about it. Forget it. It's like, you'd be blown away. You're just I'm done. Peace. I'm going to go.
So Xenia, this offering of hospitality, also kind of worked in a diplomatic sense because it made sure that foreign dignitaries, traders, and guests were going to be treated really well while they're visiting different city states throughout Greece. And so this is offered by kind of like almost like a diplomat, but not quite. It was called the Office of the Proxenos. And a proxenos was a city appointed official. He could be like a native of that city, or he would be an immigrant from a different city who is now living there. So like a resident alien. And he would look after the citizens of a specific foreign city when they visited. So like if a native citizen of Athens or a resident Corinthian living in Athens would be appointed proxenos for visitors of Corinth. So he's responsible for diplomacy between the cities. He's responsible for the interests of these citizens that are visiting. And that could be from something like just getting them tickets to a show that they want to see, or actually like helping them get an audience with a city official.
So, wait, are they like a concierge?
They are kind of like a concierge, yeah.
That sounds exactly what they are.
Like a government concierge.
Yeah.
In addition to cities, actually, trade groups and other organizations could also appoint their own proxenos to make sure that their clients are treated well when they're traveling. One thing that I thought was really interesting is that some scholarship suggests that the proxenos might also have been a bit of a spy at times, that they might actually be gathering intelligence for their native city so that if a conflict happens, they've got some intelligence to help their homeland. With all of that, there is actually little evidence that there was like a system of inns in these ancient Greek cities, although it does seem like they would set up some kind of temporary shelter during festivals and things like that for tourists that are coming in, which would have been organized like they would like have a central courtyard and then have beds and places for animals and storage and stuff like that. But it's not going to be like a formal system like we're going to see later that Rome had, because of course Rome had something formalized and intricate.
Yeah, they got their shit together.
Yeah, but even though they don't necessarily have evidence of these systems of inns, travel was still very popular in ancient Greece. People, you know, tourists are traveling all over the Mediterranean to go on religious pilgrimages, to go sightseeing. There were festivals, tons of reasons that people would have been traveling back then. So probably another reason why it was so important to have people willing to offer you lodging in their homes if there is not this system of inns for you to rely on when you're traveling.
It's also safer, right? Because if you stay at someone's home that you trust, you know, you don't have to risk bandits or people stealing your stuff or like a corrupt innkeeper. It feels safer in my opinion, especially at that time.
Yeah.
These places had a place for your horse and all your animals. And today they don't even give you freaking free parking.
Oh my God. Right.
Like, dude, they had stables for horses baked into the price.
Yeah.
And now it's like,
and it's way more work to take care of someone's horse than it is to let someone park their car and not charge $60 a night or whatever. Or make you pay for valet. Ugh. Yes. Good tangent. another reason that a lot of people traveled was to watch sports because, of course, the Olympics was a pretty big deal back then as it is now. And so that event would draw travelers from all across Greece. And they actually think that more than 50,000 people would make the journey to witness the games during the second century AD. So this is a little bit more modern, not ancient Greece, but
still, that was like all the people in the world. Like, there weren't that many people, were they? I don't think so.
I think there probably were.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Because I feel like there were not that many people.
Were more than 50,000 people.
There were more than 50,000, but like how many more?
More. Because they were big cities.
Yeah, but you know what? Okay. I looked something up. This is totally not related, but kind of. I looked up the population of the U.S. like in the beginning of the 20th century, and it was only like 75 million people or something like that. Like the amount that we have grown in the past 150 years, like, or
Google says that the global population around 1000 BCE was approximately 50 million people.
Okay, it wasn't everyone, but that means 50,000 people were a lot of people.
That was a lot of people, yeah.
That was a lot of people.
Yeah, the world, the population, of course, was nowhere near what it is now, but there was still millions of people.
Okay. I thought there were like max a million.
That brings us to the Persian Empire next. The Persian Empire did have a very formal and well laid out system of inns. So they were called caravanserai, which originates from the Persian words caravan or caravan and sarai, house. So they were roadside inns that provided shelter, food, water, you know, everything that you needed if you were a caravan, a pilgrim, you know, traveling along these trade routes, which in the Persian Empire, massive amounts of trade routes happening, including the Spice Road and the Silk Road.
Yeah. So there had to be a lot of places to stay because that was like the center of the universe.
Yes. So to put us in the timeline, the earliest caravanserais trace back to the Achaemenid Empire's Royal Road, which was around 559 BC. And for, since it is Hanukkah while we're recording this, for the Jews listening, this was during Cyrus the Great's reign of Persia. And Cyrus the Great, of course, was the Persian emperor who let us go back to Israel after the Babylonian captivity.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So we'd been...
I thought you were going to say it's Ahasuerus.
No.
I'm confused with my Persian thing.
Yeah, different one. Different story.
Oh, that's true. That is it. I'm thinking we're in Purim. Oh, God. Sorry about that.
So the Royal Road was a major ancient highway that stretched 2,500 kilometers from Sardis to Susa. Historical records, such as Herodotus's writings, indicate the existence of these structures as incredibly important elements on the road. They provided safe havens on a journey that could be incredibly dangerous. So they were all strategically placed, ensuring that no two were more than 25 miles apart, which is the maximum distance that a caravan could travel in a day.
So it was like to always have someone nearby, like a group of people.
Yeah, so that way your caravan didn't have to camp on the road, which would make you very vulnerable. And so instead, you knew that every single night you were going to be able to hit another inn.
Yeah, okay. See, smart. They figured it out.
And so in addition to offering your normal amenities of an inn, they were also, of course, important for society because there are places where people from different ethnicities, languages, religions could all gather. You think you might not be there for a very long time. You're just there for a night. But all of these people, night after night, are exchanging ideas with each other.
Yeah, I feel like this is, the Silk Road was like, that like changed the world, right?
Mm, yeah.
That basically globalized the world. I could imagine why it's so important. And also, yeah, humanized people. You know, you meet people from different backgrounds, different religions, different cultures.
Yeah, a great way to not fall prey to xenophobia.
It comes back to xenophobia. But they're designed for these caravans to come and accommodate a lot of travelers and their animals.
Yeah.
And provide security because, you know, you can't just sit in camp, as we said.
Yeah, exactly. So it gives them, you know, a measure of safety. So the layout of them was very similar to a lot of things that we still see because they actually influenced a lot of things. But they had a central courtyard, one entrance, and then rooms would surround the courtyard where there were private rooms for sleeping. There were storage areas and places to keep the animals as well.
Kind of gives motel vibes.
Yeah, a little bit. It's like roadside inn, roadside motor lodge. So this layout did evolve over the centuries, with each era kind of adding its own little spin to it, because these caravanserais were being built for basically 1400 years. Like, they were a very long lasting type of architecture in Iran.
Some of them still exist. I mean, they're not functioning, but
some of them exist and are functioning.
Stop.
Yeah.
How?
Because they turned them into hotels.
Genius.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they kept them functioning. I just saw on the UNESCO page, like, they have them that are preserved, but I didn't know that you can use them. I thought that'd be illegal.
Yeah. Well, obviously the ones that are just archaeological digs or non-functioning are, you know, they're just heritage sites to visit, but they did manage to restore some and turn them into hotels.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So that courtyard that was in the center is what served as the communal area. And that's where everybody's going to rest, exchange stories. And they would also trade goods with each other inside the caravanserai because, I mean, that's a perfect little marketplace ready, set up to go.
It's a pop-up.
Yeah. So a lot of the trading is actually happening inside of these caravanserai, which kind of makes me think of the medieval inn as well, because people would do the same thing there. As the merchants are traveling from inn to inn, they trade what they need to in the inn.
So it doesn't seem like it changed that much for quite like a few hundred years. I feel like only, not today, but maybe in the past like 100 years. Do you think that's what's missing in modern hotels, is this kind of communal area where people could do business and talk? Because I don't feel like that's the vibe.
The only place where I think that does still happen is the hotel bar. I think people are more likely to talk to people outside of their own party at the hotel bar. But yeah, but otherwise, even in the lobby, even though it's a communal area, people are keeping to themselves. They're not really talking to the other people staying at the hotel.
Yeah, that's sad. We got to bring back the pop-up shops and hotels.
So the construction of these actually continued up until the early 20th century. So this is like this unbroken tradition of architecture for Iran. And they were actually often built with donations, which sort of reflects the Islamic ethos of caring for travelers. So there's this also kind of this ongoing theme of hospitality, caring for the traveler, for the stranger, that's really important in these different cultures.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a lot of these cultures have, they take it very seriously.
Yeah.
Don't mess with the traveler.
And which, if the traveler is bringing you, you know, all of this economic bounty, I can see why they would definitely want to protect them for sure. But also, it seems like even just the regular tourist, the regular pilgrim also received this. So it wasn't just like a monetary based transactional system, but like they genuinely cared.
It also says here, well, let's finish, I guess, talking about the architecture and how there were very intricate decorations. And if anyone is familiar with like Persian art and Persian architecture and interior design, you know that it is not Scandinavian style.
Minimalism is not a thing.
It's really beautiful. And like there's like Farsi even inscribed and written on certain parts of the walls you can see in some of the pictures. Or it looks, see, I don't know if it is Farsi or it looks like Farsi, because it has that like same intricate design.
Oh, yeah.
But some of it is, I think, might be Farsi actually.
It probably is because in Iran they use the Arabic script, but they never stopped speaking Farsi. So Farsi is written in Arabic. So that's probably, it is probably Farsi that you're seeing, just it's Arabic script.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just looks like it blends in so well.
And of course, there's going to be lots of influence from Islamic architecture as Islam sweeps across the area in the 700s, I believe, and from then on. So it's going to have that like geometric mosaic vibe in some of them as well. And then the caravanserais actually influenced other architectural forms in Persia, like their mosques and palaces would, you know, start to take on this same layout.
So the caravanserai even have a place in Farsi literature, especially in poetry. They say they are used as metaphors for life's journey and the transient nature of existence.
Ooh.
Ooh, that is like deep.
Yeah.
The literature describes them as places where diverse cultures converge and mingle.
Naturally. Yeah, it makes sense. Pretty on the nose.
Yeah. They also say that the caravanserai are often used as the setting of like for tales about love and adventure and philosophical contemplation. So that makes sense because you can meet the love of your life, I guess, there, just like other people and someone, you know, giving you a job, that's an adventure, or having a political or philosophical debate. But I feel like it can be a really good setting for a love story. They romanticize a lot of the caravanserai stories is what I'm understanding.
I bet so, yeah. I can see how that would, you would kind of like how we romanticize the medieval tavern, which is why we did an episode on it. I can see how their culture would romanticize this idea of this caravanserai from the past. And all of these travelers and merchants and people coming and going and all of the stories that could happen there. This website, surfiran.com, it actually has an article about them, and they say, in Farsi literature, caravanserais often represent a microcosm of the world, a place where human interactions with all their complexities and nuances unfold. I thought that was so great. For the people who are able to go, there are caravanserais that have been converted into hotels, like the Abbasi Caravanserai in Isfahan. It was originally built during the Safavid era, which was like a 200-year era from like the 1500s to the 1700s. It's been restored and transformed into the Abbasi Hotel. It retains much of its original architecture, including the central courtyard, and is renowned for its intricate Persian artwork. So that sounds great.
Too bad we can't go.
I know. Another example is the Zainuddin Caravanserai. Does that sound right? The Zainuddin? Yeah. Sure.
It's in, it sounds good to me.
Sounds good. It's in Yazd, also in Iran. And it's an example of a caravanserai on the Silk Road, as opposed to like the Spice Road or the Royal Road. It also dates back to the Safavid era and has a distinctive circular design, which was really rare among the caravanserais, which were usually rectangular or square, because obviously that's much easier to build. I mean, these extended across like a huge geographical region. So some of them were different in their architecture because some of them are in areas where it's going to snow a lot and others are in deserts and others are, you know, mountainous areas. So their architecture does differ a little bit to kind of put up with their climate. And then I think 54 of the existing caravanserais have been made into like one giant UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Oh, wow. If they're still intact, then why not? Those are old.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's a very intrinsic part of Persian history.
If you're a part of the Silk Road, you got yeah. history.
Yeah. Finally, we have come to the Roman Empire. So this was really confusing to try to like tease out all these different types of establishments, because of course it's Rome. It's the Roman Empire was huge. You know, it developed over time, but still they were very methodical. They, you know, they always had a system in place for something, you know. So of course they had a very formal system of lodging. So that we're going to start with the Manzio or Mangio.
Before we start, is Manzio short for Manchun?
No, but the word Manchun does come from Mangio.
I knew it!
So this is an official stopping place on a Roman road. So it is maintained by the central government for the use of officials and those on official business while traveling. So they're normally in the form of a villa, and they were usually pretty big. Guests had to provide a passport to identify themselves. And they also were in like a very strict distance from each other because carts could travel about 30 kilometers a day and pedestrians a little bit further. So each one was roughly 30 kilometers from the next. In Britain, the Roman town of Vinani in Leicester, I hate the names of British places. Leicester? Yeah. Leicester?
Leicestershire.
Listerineshire?
Leicestershire.
Anyway, Leicestershire. It probably accommodated at least one Manzio, as it featured in the Antonine Itinerary, which is a 3rd century imperial travelogue.
Ooh.
Yeah, I also love, this is one thing I learned, is that like people wrote travel books. Stuff back then.
Yeah, what was it? It was like, dear diary, today, Manchester came to town.
No, it's like, I came to this town and I stayed at this Manzio, which was excellent, but I ate at this restaurant, which was shit. And the service here is terrible. Don't go here.
Okay, so Yelp did exist. Yelp did exist years and years ago, and everyone's getting all mad that they're like, oh my God, Yelp is ruining everything. Is it though?
Yeah, no, bad reviews have existed because humans don't change. This is what we see. We don't. We are the same basic creature from era to era. And yeah. We love to complain. So next up is the Kalpona. And this is for your non-official travelers. So if you're not on government business, you're probably going to maybe stay at a Kalpona. So sometimes these were at the same location as the mansiones, and they were just like off from it a little bit. So they perform the same functions. They could be a little more disreputable because they were frequented by thieves and prostitutes at times. So some of them were, some of them weren't. Graffiti on the walls of a few whose ruins have been found. I'll tell a lot about the prostitutes there.
Oh, no.
But you could also get food and drink at a Kalpona. And so that was something that was really good for travelers because not every establishment, you know, always offers the same things. Some of the Kalpona, it was going to be like basic accommodations that if there were, you know, some rooms above the shop or something.
It was kind of like a hostel, no?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, maybe not quite as cheap. I would say there were probably some other ones that were... But yeah, it kind of sounds like it. The taberna, which is where we get our word tavern, as we talked about in our last episode, was the name for a shop. It could be selling wine, cheese, books, whatever.
Yeah.
They were all taberna. I'm sorry, they were all tabernae. That's the plural form.
I thought it was tabernae.
I don't know. But the plural form of the word was used to describe roadside inns that were found between towns. And these are where genteel travelers were going to stay because they wanted something better than the Kalpanae.
So it was in between the Mansio, better than the Cabernae. It was
Yeah. Yeah, because the Manzio was for official business, you know, government workers, right, or something like that. So if you can't get into the Manzio, but you are well-heeled, you're going to maybe stay at the Tabernae.
Yeah, that makes sense. There always got to be...
We love our class hierarchies. Yeah. In the early days of the Roman roads, when most travel was official travel, not a lot of people... were just out and about. Houses placed near the road were required by law to offer hospitality on demand.
Ooh. I don't know if I would buy a house on the road, though.
I know. I bet those were cheaper than houses far from the road. Kind of like now.
Yeah.
Frequented houses, no doubt, became the first tabernae. So, you know, eventually if your house is near the road and you keep having to let these people stay, you might as well just turn it into a business. But so as Rome grew, the Tabernae did as well. They became more luxurious. They could acquire good reputations, bad reputations, depending on who's coming there. But one of the best was the Tabernae Caedicei.
Yeah, what is that?
Caedicei? I don't know. So this Tabernae that was in Sinuessa had a large storage room with barrels of wine, cheese, ham. So, you know, it's the kind that was probably more for the upper classes.
They had the food and the drink. People were there.
Yeah, but if there was a Tabernae complex, a city might grow up around it. So Rheinzabern in the Rhineland and Saverny in Alsace, which is in France, are places that started out as a taberna complex, and then the city actually grew up around it.
Oh, that's really cool. I think that happens a lot, but usually it happens with like ports and stuff.
Yeah.
Not just the Tabernae.
So both Kalpanae and Tabernae could have mixed reputations, like we said. Some people are say these are great, and some people say these are places where bad things happen.
Are you getting diseases?
Yeah. So ancient writers like Ammianus Marcellus, he regarded them as places for the poorest and lowest classes. The poet Horace regarded them as greasy. So there's a little bit definitely a little bit of class disparity happening there. That sounds like the elite being like, ew, that's where the poor people stay.
Well, the next thing, when you find out this little fact, it makes sense. Because some of the tavern eyes had a reputation that the wait staff wouldn't just offer, you know, services like food and drink, but sexual services as well.
You could
always but...
Yeah, so it's hard, like I can see why they would have mixed reputations. You got to know which one you're going to know what the amenities, wink wink, will be.
It was an all-inclusive resort. This was two for one.
Yeah, so, I mean, some of these places were indistinguishable from brothels, basically. Cicero actually owned 7 establishments like that, where you could get room, board, and a girl for the night. But he claimed it was impossible to stay more than 24 hours in one. So his probably were not best accommodations.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty. I've been in a hotel that I wouldn't have stayed. I didn't want to stay 8 hours of sleeping in it. So yeah, I can imagine how bad that was.
Can you imagine staying in any of these places at any time? Like, oh my God, the smell.
Yeah.
The smells.
I want to stay where the rich people get to stay.
Yeah. I want to stay where the rich people stay because you know that their bathrooms or buckets of feces were in a different room than you.
Yeah, and regularly dumped.
Yeah.
So the Hospitium is the actual Roman hotel. Originally, they were rented rooms in private homes, which is how their name derives
Airbnb.
From. Yeah, exactly. Their name derives from the principle of hospitia, or hospitality, which a Roman host owed to his guests. As time progressed, hospitia became solely commercial, and so many were former private homes that had been converted so that they could offer food, drink, and lodging. Many offered private dining rooms, gardens, and formal atriums. So these are really getting to be your fancy schmancy establishments. Other smaller hospitia were more basic and styled like the Capona, with a central bar area for eating and rooms for sleeping elsewhere. But these were often regarded as seedy because travelers often rented little more than a bug-infested mattress and blanket on the floor of a shared room. Gross. One famous hospitia in Pompeii, which was the higher class, was the House of Sallust, which was a house that was converted into a hotel from a private residence during the Augustan period.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so Pompeii was all wealthy people?
I think it was a lot of wealthy people because it was like where they would go to vacation and live and stuff. But I think there were, lots of people there that weren't wealthy.
Okay.
I think it's like a resort town where there's the townies and the.
That makes sense. But I feel like Pompeii would have the most well-preserved hospitium. Yes,
they do.
So we really know what went down there. So our next one is, it's a stabula. It's like a Roman motel found in the entrances of towns and cities. Their main difference from hospitia was that they offered facilities for stabling animals as well as rooms for guests. See, again, when you offer places for your horses, people are gonna like it.
It's true. So I guess that's where we get our word stable from.
Oh, stabling the animals?
Yeah, because at a stabula, they're keeping your animals.
Oh my God, we're learning the origins of English.
So much etymology in this episode. Yeah.
It was easy to recognize a stabulum. Am I saying stabulum? As it always had a ramped entrance sloping onto the street to allow access to carts and pack animals. I think this place was good if you had a lot of animals you were traveling with, because animals were accommodated in stables at the back of the premises, generally in the courtyard area faced by kitchens and latrines. Is latrines bathrooms?
Yeah.
That's such a nice word for it.
Yeah, it's way better.
At least we say bathroom. A lot of people say toilet They're like, where's the toilet? I'm like, listen, you don't need to get specific.
I know. If you just say bathroom, then maybe you just need to wash your hands. Like, we don't know what you're doing in there. It's vague.
Guests would typically stay at the front of the complex, so the animals would be in the back. Guests would stay in the front, although they could also be accommodated in rooms above the stables. You know what those rooms were for?
The poor people?
The poor people who wanted the wait staff to also give them extra services.
Because I bet the rooms above the stables don't cost as much as the rooms at the front. So what if you're rich? Then you are probably going to be staying with friends. So the elite would stay. Usually they had country villas. So when they wanted to go on vacation, they would just go to their country villa that either they or their friends owned. Many famous Roman figures owned villas in Tusculum, which was just 20 kilometers from Rome. So it was just a quick little jaunt out into the country from the big city. Campania, which is 300 kilometers south of Rome along the Amalfi Coast, was another popular tourist spot. No surprise there. I'm pretty sure the Amalfi Coast is still a very popular tourist spot. So that included well-known resort towns like Pompeii and Naples. And writings from the time even include scenes of children making sandcastles on the beach, though their sandcastles obviously are going to be in the shape of Roman villas because castles don't exist.
Oh my God, you make a very good point. Castles don't exist then.
Yeah, so you're wild? So it's so cool. Like, kids are doing exactly what they do now, but just in whatever, you know, their cultural familiarity is.
That's crazy.
So maybe on somewhere on the Silk Road, if there's a coastal area, a kid was making a sand caravanserai.
Oh, that's actually really cute. I feel like it's better than a sandcastle.
Yeah.
Probably easier too.
So there was quite a bit of travel during the Roman Empire, especially since they did have much better roads than existed before. Another reason for travel is that teachers would take their students on summer trips to escape the heat. So here they would be hosted in villas along the way. So once again, because if you're a student that has your own private tutor, your parents are pretty well off. So you're going to be able to.
When you say student and teacher, I'm like the whole class is coming.
Yeah. So it's going to be like a private tutor who has like three or four students with him or something.
Yeah.
Soldiers are also going to be part of the tourists that are going to and from, because they could take leave from their army service to, you know, explore whatever region they're in. If, you know, they can go a certain distance away to make sure that they're back on in time from their leave. And then many vacation towns were family friendly. So families are going to take these vacations just like we do now. And then, of course, some like Baiae were not family friendly. So Baiae was like the Roman Las Vegas.
And
it was known for hedonism. There were beach parties, revelry, lewd women. It was called I love how the women are always the lewd ones.
Yeah, there were no lewd men, only lewd women.
Of course, those didn't exist. but it was known as the Vortex of Luxury and the Harbor of Vice.
Ooh, those are good names for a city.
They are.
I just like the name, like, Baiae. I feel like you'd have to sing it. You can't just say, and where are you going? Bye.
So Rome had lots of places too that you could travel to. Yeah,
Rome, you're gonna party. I expected nothing less from the Romans. So technically a part of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, so maybe the most famous or infamous, notorious inn of the Roman Empire was one that was supposed to be found in a tiny little village called Bethlehem in the Roman province of Judea. this is the inn that Mary and Joseph were allegedly not able to take refuge in.
So here's the thing. I don't know the story that well, because I grew up very Jewish. I'm always learning. I really thought that Jesus was born in his garage, basically. Like his little hut outside his house where they kept like the animals. But apparently this is not true. And where did I get this information? Nowhere. My brain.
That's you had a few details and you just tried to fill in the rest the best you
could. Yeah, I just filled them in.
Yeah, so the story goes that at the time that Mary was pregnant with Jesus, that there was supposedly a empire-wide census going on, and everybody had to report back to their ancestral town to be counted for the census. And so that is why, even though Mary and Joseph lived in Nazareth, they were on their way to Bethlehem, because that was where Joseph was ancestrally from, because he's of the line of David. So they get to Bethlehem, and Mary is always seen as like she's about to pop. We don't actually know at what point in her pregnancy they would have gotten there, but Luke 2:7 says Mary gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in bands of cloth and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. So this always gives this idea of, you know, they get to town, they try to find an inn, try to get a room, and they're like, sorry, there's so many people here for this census that we just don't have any room for you. Like, go post up in our stable. And that's why the nativity scene is always in this kind of cave or stable looking area with all of the animals and the manger filled with hay. But there are problems with this whole story.
You mean there's inconsistencies
in the Bible? Inconsistencies in the dogma.
Oh, no. You're the first one to bring it up.
So looking at all of these things, these different types of hotels that are inns that we have just talked about in the Roman Empire, which one of these would they have found in Bethlehem? Well, probably none of them.
Bethlehem was different. It wasn't like, you know, Rome. I feel like they would, if anything, it would be more similar to the Persian Empire. No, it's not so fancy. They weren't fancy, the Bethlehemians.
Yeah, well, Bethlehem was a small village, so it probably didn't have an inn at all. Like, it was probably too small to even require such a thing. Not a lot of people travel into Bethlehem on the regular basis.
Yeah, so maybe they had like a, not an inn, but like a, I guess like a stable,
Well, so if you needed a place to stay when you're arriving in Bethlehem, you're probably going to, if you don't know anybody, you're probably just going to rent a guest room in someone's house. So back to that, you know, common idea of hospitality, take care of the traveler, let them stay in your home. If you have family, of course, you're going to just stay with your family in the area. So since Joseph is traveling back to his ancestral home of Bethlehem, it's very, very, very likely that they had family in the village and that's where they were going to be staying, is with a family member.
Yeah, that's true. Why would they stay at an inn if that's where they're from?
So another problem linguistically is that the English word inn in that verse is actually a Greek word. But the Greek word that means inn is pandoxion, if I'm saying that right, which is not used here. Luke uses the word katalima. And based on the verb katalio, which means to put down one's things, katalima is simply any sheltered space used as a resting place. But it also is used to just mean room. So there was no room in the room. So the custom of this region was to have a guest room upstairs for people to stay in. So Mary and Joseph aren't looking for an inn to rent a room in. They are hoping to be able to stay in the upstairs guest room of one of their relatives' houses. But because all of these visitors, all these other family members are in town for this census, they get there too late. It's full. There's no room for them in the guest house. What does that mean? Does that mean, oh no, they do have to go sleep in the stable outside? It does not. The usual design for a home in ancient Israel was known as a pillared house or a four-room house. And this pattern is pretty consistent. So among periods. So the main floor typically had four rooms, which are divided around the house's pillars. So picture like a capital letter E as the shape of the house if you're viewing it from above. And each of the four lines of the E are a room. Since Joseph and Mary can't sleep in the Cataluma, in the upper room, it doesn't mean that they have to go outside and sleep in the stable. They're actually just going to sleep on the main floor of the house, because most households did not have a special structure for the animals. That would have been a major luxury. So even though professional...
They just slept with the goats and the sheep?
So professional shepherds might have used like community sheep pens outside the city, but in the city, people just need a few sheep or goats for their household milk and stuff. So they're going to keep these penned up in the downstairs room at night. So they go outside into the yard basically during the day, and then they bring them in at night and pen them in one of the downstairs areas. And then they have like a feeding trough or something set up for them. So yeah, so Joseph and Mary would have had to go be in the area where the animals were kept at night, but they probably wouldn't have been alone. There may have been others that also showed up and there wasn't room for them. And they also chilled out on the main floor of the house.
With the goats and the sheep.
Yeah, well, they remember there's different rooms because it's an E shape. So there's...
Yeah, but whenever they do the nativity scene, it's always there's a little goat or sheep in that.
Yeah,
color.
Because... Yeah, but the nativity scene is a stable where there wouldn't really have been a separation between things. But
wait a minute, so the nativity scene is false?
Yes. The nativity scene is wrong.
Yes, for me.
Yeah, so later readers misunderstood Luke's narrative because they weren't familiar with the practice of lodging animals inside the family house on the lower floor. So, and then also, you know, the mention of a manger, of her laying Jesus in a manger, makes people just assume that, oh, this is out in the stable where the animals in the manger for them to eat are kept. They just didn't know that in Israel at this time, on the main floor is where the animals would stay. And so there would need to be a trough of some sort for them to eat. And that would have been a convenient place for Mary to lay the baby
out. I'm telling you, we're misinterpreting a lot. You know, I feel like there's a lot of things that we could.
Yeah. So they're not like out in the cold all alone giving birth as a tired poor little family. They're in their cousin's house with like people running up and down the ladder and being like, and you know, I mean,
probably offering them some snacks.
Yeah, Mary, you need to eat. Like, but yeah, so the most infamous inn in the world probably didn't exist.
Do you think that there are like inns in Bethlehem today or hotels that are like, actually,
this is where, I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are, but
Jesus
no, they
here.
Just, they just stayed with Uncle Mordechai. I mean, it was
very fascinating. So basically the last story is that there wasn't an inn at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is so ingrained in the Christmas story that there's no way that's ever going away. Like it's with us forever. But
no, I feel like a lot of things are ingrained. I mean, we were talking about this last time, is that a lot of Christmas traditions are pagan. Like no one's going to ever take that away.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Just it's part of it now. It's just
have to accept it.
It's just part of the Christmas lore.
Thanks for listening to Hotel History. You can follow us on most social media platforms, Patreon, and Substack by searching for Hotel History or Hotel History Podcast.
If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so we can reach more listeners.